This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
That's the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth. Jan Swofford is a professor of music, composer, and the author of Beethoven, Anguish and Triumph, joining us on the program this morning. Hello, Jan.
Hi, Trevor. How are you doing?
Good. Can you tell us the story behind Beethoven's Fifth?
Well, he had kind of made his big breakout in symphonies with the Third Symphony, the Eroica. And that was very much his full-scale heroic style. Then he had written the Fourth Symphony, which is kind of a much milder, so almost comic piece. And I think for every symphony he wrote, he wanted to do something radically different from the things around it. So in the Fifth, I think he wanted to do something that was... In the Fourth, he simplified the music to a good degree, to a good extent, and simplified the form. I think the idea in the Fifth was that he wanted simplicity plus intensity, and it just hits you absolutely in the jugular. It's an enormously powerful and concentrated piece, and to a remarkable degree, it's just based on a very few simple ideas. Partly that opening rhythm, da-da-da-dum, that goes all the way to the end of the piece and one disguise after another. So I think he wanted to get an enormous amount of music out of some very simple and direct and powerful material.
Why was he important to music at that time or of that era?
He was very much, he's usually called a revolutionary and has been since his own time. I saw no indication that he intended to be a revolutionary. I ended up calling him a radical evolutionary. Everything he did was founded on the past, and especially Haydn and Mozart. And he was really the heir of Haydn and Mozart. He founded what he did on what they did, and took it in a particular direction that was unique to him, that was more intense and more personal in some ways. So I think what he meant to his time, though, people often get this impression that people who are radical in one way or another that causes them problems, that people have trouble with their radicalism. Some people did have trouble with Beethoven's radicalism, but basically his fans, his audience, were young romantics, the romantic generation, and the more radical he was, the better, as far as they were concerned. So he really became the composer for the young generation of what we call romanticism.
What sort of an era was that? Because it goes from classical to romantic. Can you explain what that means?
Well, to begin with, what periods in music and periods in literature and culture are, they have different dates is what it amounts to. Romanticism in the arts really began in the 18th century. And it didn't begin in music until really Beethoven is sort of the transition into romanticism. I don't think Beethoven was a romantic at heart at all. The difference is the 18th century, what we call the Age of Reason, the Enlightenment, and the musically, the period of Haydn and Mozart, was a period when restraint and logic and clarity were valued, when most music was not particularly tragic. There was a great sense of hopefulness. There was a sense of putting aside dogma and going into an age of rationality and rational governments. Romanticism, on the other hand, was a rebellion against that. Romanticism prized the wild and the imaginative and the singular and the unique and the ineffable and even bizarre and excessive. Romanticism was a doctrine of emotion above all, which is not what the 18th century was. And Beethoven, who I think was an 18th century person in his background and his sensibility, simply played into the new spirit. And that spirit, in a way, I think fed back into his music and the late music.
We've got a few people with questions to ask. We might take some calls and they'll come back and talk to you a little bit about his history and how he became the composer that he is. Mike, good morning.
Mate, you made a comment earlier about Beethoven being a classical composer. I take note that the style of music we now refer to as classical music, it was pretty much the only style of music, sort of, that whether it be Mozart or Haydn or Beethoven himself, composed. Everybody sort of used orchestral because they didn't have the electronic music. They didn't have the type of drums, the type of guitars, and so forth that we now consider the norm for making music from.
Mike, let me go back to Jan and talk about that, because we've just been talking about the Romantic era, Jan. For many of us who listen to classical music, and this is moving away from Beethoven a little bit, but you might be able to explain to us the subtle differences between the different types of classical music, of what Beethoven was doing, what Mozart was doing, and what Brahms was doing, perhaps.
Well, I think Beethoven took what Haydn and Mozart did. The way I was taught and my generation was taught is that it was Beethoven who made the symphony the king of instrumental musical forms. It's not true. Haydn and Mozart did that in their late symphonies. Beethoven took what they did and did everything more. His symphonies are longer. He redid the kind of weights and balances of the form. He made the last movements more and more the goal of the piece, whereas the first movement in Haydn and Mozart tends to be the heaviest and the last movement fairly light. Beethoven put the scherzo, this light, fast, three-beat movement, into the symphony. He wrote longer development sections, and there's much more of a sense of individual personality. One way I've always put it is that Mozart likes to seduce his listeners. Beethoven tends to grab you by the lapels and cry that he has something very important to tell you. It's a difference in tone and attitude.
Did he always write like that?
Oh, not at all. Beethoven has what we call three periods, and that was something people talked about for a long time, and I think it's basically true. But the first period, a lot of it is very 18th century music. If you hear his first set of string quartets, Opus 18, you wouldn't most of the time really know it was him. They sound kind of Haydn-esque. At the same time, the Pathetic Piano Sonata, which is Opus 13, is absolutely Beethoven. Anybody would know that's Beethoven. So it's complicated. Some of his earlier music is very much in the mode of the 18th century, reminiscent of Haydn and Mozart. But he already, especially when he was writing per piano, had a really distinctive voice of his own that we call Beethoven.
Frank, hello.
Yeah, I'm just interested. There was a guy called Howard Goodall who did a show on the ABC called His Big Bang Theory of Music about technology and the influence it had on composers. And he basically had the argument with Beethoven and his piano music about how it was like a guy getting a Porsche after having a horse and cart. And he basically took it on a grand tour of all the sound possibilities and, combined with, I guess, the romantic sort of sensibility, he opened up a whole sound universe. He was a great musical engineer in a way, and that was sort of Howard Gould's argument. I just wondered what Jan thinks of that.
Jan?
Let me talk about that in relation to the piano. It's a very interesting question, especially when we get into technology. The piano was in a period of evolution during Beethoven's time from what he said. He wrote a piano maker in the 1790s and said, you know, the piano is the least developed of all instruments. Sometimes you just think you're playing a harp. Pianos had a very light sound. They were kind of tricky, but it wasn't a unified evolution. Every region had its own styles. Every maker had their own tricks. By the time Beethoven died, if you heard the kind of Graf piano, which I have, that he was playing at the end of his life, because it was the loudest and he was mostly deaf by then, it sounds verging on a modern piano. So what I'm getting at is that he wrote for the instruments that he had, even though he was very dissatisfied with them. And the move from kind of light harpsichordish pianos of his early years to the much louder, heavier pianos of his later years is absolutely reflected in the evolution of his music that he wrote for piano. So there's absolutely a case of technology, the technology of piano making being directly reflected in the music a great composer was writing. And by the way, he was close to some piano makers and very much, they were very interested in what he thought. And he told them what he thought, and to a degree they tried to do what he said. You know, every time they put new notes at the top of the piano, he'd immediately use them. And so they had to keep making those pianos. He was very interested in technology. He was interested in a guy named Meltzel who made automatons and mechanical musicians and things like that. And he was very interested in the metronome, which was a new technology invented by Meltzel to set definite tempos for the first time ever.
Max joins us. Hello, Max.
Good morning, Professor. Wonderful to talk to you. I see Beethoven took the aloofness from the drawing room concerts to the concert hall. The first composer to do so, as the professor said, Haydn was the influence there. After Haydn came Beethoven. And, of course, the Third Symphony, the Eroica, was far different than the other symphony. And the pastoral, again, the Sixth Symphony changed history again. He put five movements in it. And also the scherzo came in. And the Ninth Symphony, that everyone knows, was a huge orchestra and chorus for the Choral Symphony. So Beethoven certainly did change the course of music. Incidentally, finally, before I go, Beethoven's music of those first four notes of the Fifth Symphony were used in the Second World War, not by the Germans, but by the British as their secret code.
Oh, thank you, Max.
Yes.
The British used that because dot, 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 dash is the Morse code for V, which became the symbol for victory. So Beethoven played very nicely into that.
Was he, because I played a little bit, I don't know if you've heard it, there's a kid's piece called Beethoven Lives Upstairs, and I played a little bit of that earlier, and the boy describes him as a gruff, grumpy man who lives upstairs, who clashes and bangs and makes a lot of noise as he's deaf. Was he gruff and grumpy, and was he like that all the time?
He was gruff and grumpy some of the time, and he certainly made a lot of noise when he composed. But he could also be quite funny and charming and really compelling, but you never knew when he was going to switch. You never knew when he was going to turn on you, and nearly all his friends now and then he did turn on them. He was being deaf. When he started going deaf, an old friend of his wrote back to people in Bonn where they grew up, "You have no idea the effect this has had on his social life, his sociability. It's made him more withdrawn. It's made him less sensitive to people. It's been a disaster for him." And he was pretty withdrawn and paranoid and a little bit misanthropic to start with.
So it wasn't just his deafness that made him more remote with people. He was a little bit that way anyway.
He started off that way. Yeah, he was a very. People who are reared in a relentless discipline like music or sports or whatever it is they often don't really learn how to live very well. I once had a long discussion about this with a violin teacher at Juilliard who had taught a lot of prodigies. And she said they learned to play the fiddle or the piano. They don't learn how to live. And Beethoven never really did learn how to live in the world, but he was mostly around people who forgave him because they knew a genius when they saw one. I want to say something else to the caller's point about taking music out of the drawing room. I think that's to a certain degree true, though only partly. Things like string quartets and orchestra music were becoming more public and professionalized in Beethoven's lifetime, and he was very much part of that process. At the same time, he played in drawing rooms a lot. That's still where chamber music was played. Piano sonatas were never played in public, and string quartets rarely were, and chamber music was played in private homes and chambers. So the other thing about the Ninth Symphony in particular is that it didn't catch on for a long time very well, because it really required the kind of virtuoso conductors to make sense out of that piece and control it. It just didn't exist in its time. Those kind of conductors didn't appear until 30, 40, 50 years later, and that's when the Ninth Symphony really began to take the significance in the world that it has now.
Was he a child prodigy, or did he develop as he learnt music more?
He was a child prodigy of the first rank. When he was age 10, he got a new teacher, and the teacher wrote a magazine article saying, if this kid keeps going the way he is, he's going to be the next Mozart. And, you know, Mozart was the definition of a prodigy. Beethoven of a prodigy, even then, and then Mozart was, you know, at this point, I don't know, 30 years old or so. And Beethoven simply took that in stride at age 10 and never doubted it and lived the rest of his life assuming that's what he was.
So did he start writing at a young age, or was he an incredibly gifted player? What was he?
He published a piece that he wrote at 10, some theme variations. They're not anything special. And he did not write nearly as much or as amazing stuff in his teens as Mozart did. That's partly because he didn't have Mozart's dad, who was an incredible teacher. But it's also, I think, because Beethoven was absolutely determined to be a composer/pianist. And he really spent most of his teens working more on piano than composing. So that by the time he left Bonn at age 22 to go to Vienna, he was probably one of the greatest pianists in the world at that point, and his main development as a composer came in the next few years after that.
Was there a reason that he just didn't continue on as a piano player and being recognized as a great piano player instead of composition?
Because he was going deaf, that's why.
Oh, okay.
He knew when he started going deaf in his late 20s, and he knew. There's a famous letter he wrote called the Hollingenstadt Testament, where he is basically recognizing it's the point that happens for a person with a disability when they crash. They realize they're stuck with it. They're not going to get better. And that's what you see in this letter. And at that point, he realized that his career as a pianist, as a soloist, was doomed. And from that, he was going to, before long, be nothing but a composer. And you have to realize, being a pianist was half his identity. That was one problem. Another problem is that you make a lot more money playing piano than you do composing. So in order to just keep a roof over his head as a composer, he was going to have to up his game, and he certainly did. What he wrote in the next 6 or 7 years is simply beyond belief.
So does that mean if he hadn't lost his hearing, we may not have got these compositions?
We would have probably gotten some great compositions, but they would not have been the same. And whether there would have been as many of them, who knows? That I don't know. But I think going deaf changed him and changed his music, especially in the late music, where he was never 100% deaf, but he was functionally deaf. And I think some of the quality of the late music, the sublime kind of inward quality, has to do with the fact that he couldn't hear it in the world anymore. You could only hear it in his head.
Max, another Max joins us. Hello, Max.
Yes, good morning, Trevor, and good morning, Professor. I guess I'm a bit of a Beethoven tragic. I've walked through Beethoven's house, and I've looked at his piano, and There are two of his pieces that are very meaningful to me. The first one is the tune that's previously been mentioned, where the BBC used it as a preface to the secret messages to the agents. The other one was Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. Now, in the Queensland School Reader book, there's a story about Beethoven composing this as he walked through the lanes listening to a blind girl playing a piano. Apparently, that's not true. In fact, according to the Encyclopaedia Britannica, Beethoven composed that the Moonlight Sonata because he was secretly in love with a teenage Italian noblewoman, a Countess Giulietta Zuccardi. She was totally unaware of this. And when I heard the professor talking about the Romantic period, it immediately brought that to my mind. I'm wondering if the professor can confirm that the message in the Encyclopaedia Britannica is true.
John?
I'm online because I'm a scholar of these things. I'm supposed to know this, but I'm just trying to make sure that it really was. Yes, it was dedicated to Giulietta Guicciardi, who was a teenage piano student at Beethoven's that he was in love with, basically. But she was one of several women he fell in love with who were nobility, and basically, when you were a noble woman, you didn't marry a commoner. It very rarely happened because you lost a lot of your privileges if you did. You didn't lose your title, but you could lose your children, for one thing. I want to say two things about the Moonlight Sonata. One is that's not Beethoven's title. That was given it by a publisher some years later. And I think it's an unfortunate name, but we're stuck with it. Secondly, that piece was instantly famous. It was a sensation when it was first published because the first movement in the first place sounds like nothing else. It has a mood, an atmosphere that is unique to itself and absolutely haunting. And secondly, almost anybody can play it. And so the combination of those two things, I think, made this piece virtually a legend from the day it was published.
So was he considered to be, for his time, a popular artist, a popular composer that was sort of the people?
Yes and no. His stuff was considered to be very difficult, which a lot of it is. And remember that most of the musicians who played things in those days were amateurs. Though some of those amateurs were very, very good. He wrote some pieces that were popularistic, like Wellington's Victory, the famous potboiler orchestra piece. Other pieces that were considered very difficult, though the fact is the Eroica, the most really revolutionary symphony ever written within 2 years, was being called in the leading music magazine of the time the greatest symphony ever written. So the idea that these things take decades to be absorbed is not true. Some people have said Beethoven was a rock star at the time. It doesn't apply because rock star is a function of modern media. And Beethoven was only heard by relatively few people when he played live. His music was mostly spread by sheet music, and he sold very, very well. So what I'd say is he was never the most popular composer around because he was considered difficult. On the other hand, he was one of the better-selling composers in sheet music. He is the first composer in history who was published from the very beginning. Mozart wasn't, Haydn wasn't, Beethoven was.
George, good morning.
I just wanted to ask, firstly, just about the deafness, because the subject was brought up. What's the latest thinking about how he developed it? Because there's so many stories about from syphilis from his mother or something, and then there's other things about when he fell over. So if that's the first question. The second thing I wanted to ask, Professor, was about Beethoven probably didn't compose as much vocal music as a lot of his contemporaries. He did one opera and I think a couple of oratorios and obviously the Ode to Joy in his the last movement of his Ninth Symphony has got vocals, and the Missus Solemnis, which is sort of his pseudo-tenth symphony, has got. But for a composer of his stature, he didn't composed a lot of vocal music and choral music, which was very popular, particularly oratorio. So you'd think he would have composed it because it was very popular at the time. So just wondering what his thinking was, well, just because he didn't like it, or he found it not fulfilling, or...
Jan, the second question first.
These are very good questions. He didn't write a lot of vocal music because he didn't find it sympathetic to him. And the fact is, he did not write for the voice very well. If you, in terms, technically, he didn't write very well for the voice. He was, you know, as he supposedly said to a violinist once, "What do I care about your miserable fiddle with the voice? Boos me." And he sort of felt the same way about the voice. He wrote killing vocal parts in the Missa Solemnis in the Ninth Symphony. They're murderous, especially in the sopranos. And he found great difficulty in writing vocal music, even though he wrote a certain amount. But Mozart, for example, was kind of an innately vocal composer. He did that from an early age. He understood the voice. He loved doing it. I think Beethoven wrote an opera because he said, "I must write opera," as much as anything. "This is a great medium, and I must do it, and I want to make a statement in the process of doing it, some kind of a great ethical statement." So vocal music just wasn't as simpatico to him as it was to Mozart.
And his hearing loss?
I think part of the trouble with his late vocal music, the Missa and the Ninth Symphony, is because he couldn't hear anymore, and he couldn't hear what sopranos sounded like screeching on high A's for bar after bar. So that, I mean, I'm not saying anything new. You can talk to almost any choral member who sung the Ninth Symphony. I think they'll tell you about the same. It is one of his sopranos at the premiere of the Ninth said, discuss, "Well, I guess I'll just have to go on torturing myself for art." As far as the reason for his deafness, we don't really know. He did not have syphilis, or if he did, it never went to term. One possibility is typhus, which he had in the 1790s, which can affect your hearing. He may have had lead poisoning. His gut was a mess all his life. And that could have been lead poisoning. We're not entirely sure. But lead poisoning doesn't tend to mess up your hearing, as far as I know. So we don't entirely know what ruined his hearing.
Mick, good morning.
I've got a question about the music itself. Okay, a composer writes the main theme of it. Every instrument, he has to write the harmony for that, true?
Yeah, it's, are you asking about the orchestral composing and how he would do it when he's deaf?
Pretty much, yeah. How do you come up with all those harmony lines for all those different instruments? It's fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I wanted to ask you as well, Jan, is that the ability to be... Is it that his ability to remember what all of the instruments sounded like and be able to put them together as a composer, is that one of the things that was amazing about him as well through his deafness?
Well, it's not unusual for a composer. Composers are expected to do that, and they're also expected, especially in those days when harmony was very rationalized, to be able to compose in their head complete with harmony. However, that being said, he had an extraordinary ability to do that even when he was deaf. And I'm a composer, and what boggles me is that not just that he could write orchestra music and string quartets when he was deaf, but his whole conception of orchestral sound and string quartet sound developed when he was deaf in very particular and effective directions. So he kept developing and changing his sound, in effect, as an orchestra composer, as an instrumental composer, even after he was deaf. And even though he made mistakes in scoring things that don't balance and things like that in the later music, things that he would have caught if he had performed these things and heard them, still, just compare the way the Ninth Symphony sounds to the way the First Symphony sounds, and you'll see what I mean. They just are two completely different worlds of orchestral sound.
So is it through his memory that he was inspired to do the orchestras that he wrote, the music that he wrote? Is it through memories or is it through experiences? What were the things that brought that music to him?
Well, it was just basic competence as a composer. Again, I've written for orchestra. If you were a composer, you know how to do that. You know what every string on the violin sounds like. You know what the range of the clarinet sounds like and what its different registers sound like. And you have a vivid image of these instruments in your head. And Beethoven simply had that to a supreme degree. The simple reality is Beethoven said to a publisher once, wrote to a publisher, "Outside music, everything I do is badly done and stupid." But as a musician, Beethoven was supreme in every respect. He was a supreme composer. He was a supreme performer when he was playing. He was a supreme businessman of music. The way he sold his music and managed his career was very, very astute. So everything to do with his art, Beethoven was a great master of, and that includes how you write for orchestra. But it was not a static thing for him, because he developed all his life. And developed again, even when he was deaf, he kept developing his sense of the orchestra.
As well as a sense of the orchestra, what were the things that inspired him to write? Because if his hearing is going or gone, it may not be things that he hears around him. Is it the things that he sees around him, the things that he experiences?
By and large, he was inspired by a commission. The most inspiring thing you can have as a composer is a large check. Though the Ninth Symphony is when he got, he sort of, to a degree, I think, wangled the commission for that, if that's the right word. It originally came from England, and he wanted to write the piece, but he didn't really start it until he had a commission. In the case of Mozart, for example, he didn't write that much on commission, but he always wrote with a particular performance in mind. So he would say, you know, I've got a concert coming up. I want to write a new symphony or concerto for it. And Beethoven was sometimes inspired by that too. So, and remember, he had sketchbooks where he had there are ideas for about 200 symphonies in the sketchbooks. So he always had a lot of ideas floating around for pieces that maybe were ready to write. But when he actually wrote them, he was very concerned with getting paid for them.
When you talk about commissions, though, so what would the commission look like? What would it be? Okay, we want you to write this, or this is the idea. What would the commission be?
That was basically it. We want you to write me a symphony. These would usually come from rich people, often aristocrats. Write me a symphony, dedicate it to me. I will pay you so much. And often, especially with chamber music and commissions for chamber music and piano sonatas and things like that, the person who commissioned them would get exclusive use of them and possession of them for a period of time, like 6 months before they were published. So they would get the commission, and at a certain point, people began to feel, you know, if I get a commission from, if I get a dedication from Beethoven, I'm going to be immortal. This is going to preserve my name in history. So, and meanwhile, if they were a performer, they got to play the pieces themselves exclusively for a period of time. And that was a common deal. And by the way, Beethoven picked up from Haydn a very clever trick. He would sell the same piece to different publishers in different places. He would sell it in England, he would sell it in Germany, he would sell it in France, and get paid for the same piece three or four times. And those publishers would have exclusive rights to the piece in their territory.
Is it true that he cut the legs off the piano so that he could hear or feel the vibrations to be able to write?
It's possible. There is a story that he had two pianos in a room and one of them was on the floor. He did everything he could to somehow get the sound into his head, including touching a pencil to the string so he could feel the vibration, which to me is just the most sad thing in the world. And he had a sort of amplification device built into one of his pianos. We don't know exactly what it looked like, but it was some sort of a metal thing that amplified the sound and sent it toward his ears. And he used ear trumpets too. He had those made. He did everything he could to hear, but, you know, at a certain point it just didn't work anymore.
Jen, did he write memoirs? How do we know about him and his experiences and his life? Was it from things that he'd written to other people? Was it letters? How do we get the information about him?
Well,
composers, let's say, in Mozart's and Haydn's day were just less important in the general scheme of things in the world. By Beethoven's time, composers were becoming important. And there, for that reason, people paid more attention to what they said and wrote, and they kept their letters. So we know a lot about Beethoven, more than, as far as I know, any other composer before him, partly because we have hundreds and hundreds of letters. We have things that he said that people quoted, though some people were reliable and some aren't in that. Some people also forged his letters. So we have accounts, we have people quoting him, and we have his letters, and we have concerts that we know he played on. We have a lot of people who met him and talked about it, because he was really a kind of mythological figure by the time he died. And the romantic myth of the divinely inspired suffering genius, which was applied to all genius in the romantic 19th century, that myth really was founded more on Beethoven than anybody else. So people paid attention to everything he did and said.
Jan Swofford is a professor of music, composer, and the author of Beethoven, Anguish and Triumph. Jan, what was his anguish?
Oh, it was endless. In the first place, he was in physical pain a great deal of the time. He probably had what amounted, you can't, chronic episodes of vomiting and diarrhea. He had just enormously painful gut for his whole life. He had just a row of diseases on top of that, typhus. At one point, he had massive headaches for the better part of a year, and he had eye infections later. The row of his illnesses is heartbreaking. And besides that, besides the fact that he went deaf, all that's on top of that, he had an incredible ability to work through pain. But in addition to all that, he just heaped pain on himself in one way or another by fighting with his friends and insisting on adopting his brother, his late brother's son, his nephew, which just led to endless misery, and finally led to the nephew putting two guns to his head and trying to blow his brains out. But he actually failed in his suicide attempt, and Beethoven was devastated by that. That's part of what killed him. So Beethoven lived with an enormous amount of physical and mental pain, and a lot of the mental pain he did to himself.
And was the triumph more than just his music?
I'd say it's his music, but also his achievement in triumphing over his pain, over all the pain in his music, in his life, and still managing to achieve an incredible amount. I'll add to the pain, he was probably alcoholic. He died of cirrhosis of the liver, and his father and grandmother were both seriously alcoholic. And he triumphed over that too. I don't think he drank when he composed. My theory is that a lot of the often rowdy tone of his letters has to do with the fact that he may have been drinking when he was writing letters.
We're going to go out playing a little bit of the third movement from Symphony No. 3. Can you just tell us a little bit about that as we go?
Well, this is the scherzo. The third symphony is called The Eroica. Was originally written, every last note is something called Bonaparte, so it was written about Napoleon. And I probably don't have time to tell the story of why he changed the dedication, but this is the scherzo of the third symphony, which follows the second movement, which is a funeral march, because the first movement is really about a battle or a military campaign. This is a program piece, a piece about a topic. The second movement is a funeral march, and the third movement, I think, is the return to life and joy after the burial of the dead, which is part of the story of that symphony, which leads to, in the end of the last movement, absolute triumph after what the hero has given to humanity.
Jan, it's been an absolute pleasure talking today and covering a little bit of Beethoven's life. Thank you again.
Thank you. It's been great fun. Take care, Trevor.
Thank you. Jan Swofford is a professor of music and the composer and the author of Beethoven, Anguish and Triumph.